Welcome to Hollyrood Ungagged, the Gandalf the Grey political podcast. Season 3, episode 5. I'm your host, David McClement, broadcasting from the Blantyre Free State. And joining me tonight is my faithful companion, my guy's digital Michelangelo, Miss Deborah Torrance. Hi Deborah, how are you?
Hiya, how you doing?
Not bad, apart from stuttering over my intro there.
It's because you said that Lord of the Rings was better than Star Wars. That's your karma.
I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt though, so I've kind of balanced it out, but I stand by that. And standing in for Brian this week is my good friend, journalist and Republican socialist, Mr. Connor Beaton. Hi Connor, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hi David, hi Deborah, thanks very much for having me. I'm good, and I'm joining you from sunny Dundee, the best site in Scotland, by the way.
I don't think Andy is going to disagree with that, given the political stance of Dundee. Yeah, thanks for joining us though, because, you know, Brian's pissed off in his holidays again. He was only back a week. He was a week in Montenegro, and he's back for a week. And then, where is he this week, Deborah?
España.
Spain. Where will he be next week? Who knows?
A man of the world.
So we just get straight into it then? Or is anybody, any pressing news they want to chat? What is rhyming with me this week?
Is I don't know,
any
but...
pressing things they want to talk about, or any important personal information? Or just any witty banter? As Deborah was good to point out to Connor that it's okay to banter.
Just some people might come on the pod and be like, this is stressful. And as Connor's just experienced, we are completely and utterly relaxed about everything.
And also point out that Connor had mentioned that he hasn't actually listened to the podcast, so we might not know the ambience. I assumed he was a great big fan, but
I have to be clear that I don't listen to podcasts kind of full stop. It's not a specific issue with Hollyrood Ungagged. I have listened to a little bit. And of course, I've got great admiration for the people who run it. So obviously, I'll have to force myself to listen to it going forward from this.
Okay,
oh, that's
nice. You get a pass.
You can come back.
What were you saying about your brother there, though?
No, I was just saying my brother's decided to walk the West Highland Way today. So turned up at my ma's this morning, nice and early. And then they phoned me about lunchtime. Can you come and get us? They were at Drummond. They were knackered. They had to stop halfway to get a steak pie, which I think it's a good way to do the West Highland Way.
Is it now abandoned? Or was it just a pause? Or is that it?
No, they're pausing it for a week because they said their legs were hanging off. So I went and picked them up at Drummond and brought them back, and my brother fell asleep in my mum's couch. Another one went away.
He's like, I hope next week they're starting from the beginning again. No cheating.
I just date in stages.
I know. They'll do it for Drummond to Balmaha next. I'm like, that's no very long walk.
I know, I've heard these places, but I have no idea if that's far or not.
Have you got no news, David?
Well, you touched on it. I did get a lot of flack because I've watched Lord of the Rings and came to the realisation that it is levels above Star Wars. I think it's just my childhood memories that was making me think Star Wars was better, but I stand by it. Watched it with my children, trying to introduce them to the classic. And I just couldn't get away with it. We only watched the first film, and I just thought, there is so many like classic moments in this film that I had forgot about. And Star Wars just doesn't touch it.
See, that's the kind of opinion that will earn you a guest spot in my partner's podcast, which is dedicated to Lord of the Rings.
I had no idea. you did tell me that, but there we go.
Yeah. She is a huge Star Wars fan from childhood and has recently become a mad Lord of the Rings fan. So I think she would agree with your assessment, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like them both. I've always liked them both, and I would never have really particularly argued one with the other, but I don't know. I think maybe just Star Wars has been watered down with so many lukewarm sequels. And I watched the original trilogy not that long ago, and it's just not as good as you remember it.
I disagree so much. I can't handle it. I think that
if the original trilogy came out now with the current Star Wars fan base, they would rip it apart. Because the things that they let go, like, why is Luke kissing his sister? It's the same mistakes they made in the other trilogies, but just make one at a time and no thinking about what the next film is going to be.
I just think the Star Wars trilogy, the original started trilogies. I just think it was so expansive and so fundamental. We're doing a film pod review again, Hank. We need to stop doing this. It's because we've got a secret wish to be a film review podcast, I think. But no, I just think that you're wrong. That's all I'm saying on it. Star Wars is
far superior. It is.
I've read the books. I've watched it. I'm dull about trolls and shit. And orcs and all the rest of it. And find a ring, my precious. I'd know any. I think it's got me in common with Harry Potter.
That's what Molly kept
controversial.
Saying. My 9-year-old kept saying. This is a bit like Harry Potter. Was like, this was first. Harry Potter is derivative. Yep. It has been ripped off. Everything, nothing about it is original.
And then I think we can all agree.
I remember there was shouting at a 9-year-old. So like,
well, I agree with Molly. I think you're wrong, David.
Well, we can agree to disagree. You're allowed to be as wrong as you want. Okay, let's get into it. Let's get ungagged. And it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. Stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice, nice to hear you smile. And we're back. I think that must be the longest intro we've done. Let's move on to first point in the agenda. This week, following the local elections 2 weeks ago, all the results were in and the parties were jockeying to decide what the administrations were going to be. And 27 out of the 32 councils are no overall control. The exceptions are Dundee, which is an SNP majority, Western Bloc, Bartonshire, which is a Labour majority, and then there is the three island councils, which are independent majorities. I think the best way to characterise a lot of these issues is Labour's absolute refusal to engage with the SNP and their under-the-table, nod-and-a-wink deals that seem to have done with the Tories in a lot of places. Conor, what's your thoughts?
I mean, I agree. I think you're right in your assessment about where the parties stand. And I think the first thing I'd say about local elections is there weren't really very local elections because most of the parties were actually campaigning around national issues. Local politics didn't really figure into it very much. And so I think the outcome of it as well is kind of coloured by this national political question. And the way it stands now, Labour refusing to make deals with the SNP, it doesn't really make sense if you see it from a perspective of, you know, these are parties that want to go into local government, they want to make decisions and they want to do the best thing that they can do in a council. But it does make sense actually if you see it as part of a national political strategy, because I think what the Labour Party is trying to do is send out the message very firmly under Nana Starmer that you can have progressive change with the Labour Party, but you have to turn your back on independence and the SNP, and there's no compromise position between these two things. And that, unfortunately, means they can't countenance going into any council administrations with the SNP. And it does mean that they force themselves in this position where they have to make deals with Tories and Lib Dems to get a whiff of power. And to be honest, they've also had to give up on a degree of power. Like, they're probably not going to be in administration in Edinburgh again, but I think that's probably the price they're willing to pay, because they get to really reinforce this message that, you know, oh, they think the cost of living crisis has pushed independence to the sidelines. They think if they can make an offer, you know, £1,000 off your bills, wouldn't that be great? The catch is you have to do that with us, and you have to do that with the union, and you have to do that as part of this project of changing the UK for the better. There's no chance of this happening with independence. There's no chance of this happening if you continue to vote SNP. And it's like a bribe almost, you know, and it's bribe, threat, whatever way you want to put it. But it's like, if you want things to get better, then that's the red line. It's our way or it's their way. There's no middle ground.
Yeah, it's kind of like forcing an ultimatum in the electorate. And to be honest, history has shown that when Labour forced the voters to choose between themselves, Scottish Labour and the SNP, most of the time they seem to go with the SNP. Deborah, what's your thoughts?
Well, in Eastern Bartonshire, Labour sort of bucked the trend supported an SNP minority administration, informally, of course. But I was just looking at the total votes for the council elections. Have you seen some of the stats on that? The Greens done really well. They got 110,791 votes across the board. SNP got 633,252, which was expected the highest. But Labour coming in second, I mean, they were closer to the Tories than they were to us. And I don't understand why they're being hailed as such, you know, it's such a big victory. And like you're saying, it is a bribe. It's a bribe what they're doing. It's almost like an emotional blackmail sort of thing. Like, I know a lot of people who voted for Labour because they were annoyed at what's been going on with the SNP, especially in Glasgow City Council. But I don't understand why they would go back to Labour in that instance. Like, you know, they were the cause of the situation. I don't know how you feel about South Lanarkshire, David. Oh, wait, yes, I do, because you told us.
Yeah, well, South Lanarkshire's now got a Labour-Liberal coalition that get voted through with Tory support. I'm kind of furious because, you know...
So you should be.
You know, there was no overall control, but to me, if you're going to have a minority council, it should be the largest party should get that option. And even with the Lib Dems joining Labour, it's still only bringing them up to level in terms of number of seats. I don't think it's going to be good for South Lanarkshire because seemingly there's already rumblings within the Labour group about defections and people not happy, and you know they're just going to end up with this lame duck council that can't really get anything done. And the SNP will be in quite a good position because they'll just be able to, you know, wreck anything Labour try. And you know, maybe good for the party political side of it, but it's not going to be good. I don't see how it's good for the other services.
What about over in Fife, Connor, your side of the country? What is it? The Labour have got 20 administration and the opposition's 55.
Like, yeah. So I
wild.
I grew up in Fife, Northeast Fife. And I lived in Tayport actually a couple of years ago, although I can't say I'm like particularly involved with Fife politics. But, you know, people I've spoken to in Fife who have been around for a long time saying to me, it is unbelievable to imagine the Labour Party in Fife making a deal with the Conservatives. It's just such a, you know, if you look at Fife's radical history, which has an incredible radical history, and it's mm-hmm. actually a very underappreciated radical history. There's a whole, I've been meaning to go down to Edinburgh because I want to poke around in the National Library and look at papers from the Fife Socialist League that had wow. this presence in the 1950s.
Fife had a communist MP for a number of years.
Yeah. One of the only ones. And, you know, to see the Labour Party suddenly turn around and go into bed with, you know, one of the most right-wing Tory parties we've ever had. I just think it is disgraceful, and it's been seen as disgraceful. I also think, you know, just coming up the East Coast a little bit to Dundee, where I live, you know, the SNP got the majority back here. I was a little bit surprised by that. But I think also it's reflective of how much this is about national politics. I don't really think people in Dundee are... I don't think people are huge fans of the council administration, to be honest. I'm not a huge fan of the council administration, but I don't think that's unique to Dundee, and I don't think that's unique to it being an SNP administration. I actually don't think a lot of people anywhere in Scotland are big fans of their local council. And I feel a little bit of sympathy because I did a few interviews just in the council election campaign with some left-wing councillors. So I spoke to Jim Boland in Western Bartonshire, and I spoke to Ian Scott in Shetland. And I think something that really came through in speaking to both of them is this perception that they have from the inside of actually it's the unelected officers who really call the shots in the councils and kind of set the agenda. And the councillors, you know, between parties, there's a little bit of shift, but they tend to kind of go with what is being put down from the top. And those are people, you know, like chief executives of councils or planning officers or whoever, you know, last from administration to administration. So even though, you know, I think it's... I almost say, like, it's, instead of just saying, you know, it's good or bad, Labour's back in Western Bartonshire, or the SNP is back in Dundee, or that Labour's relying on the Tories in Fife or in Stirling or wherever else, I'm not sure how much of a difference it's actually going to make to a lot of the council administration's policies. Because either you've got officers calling the shots, or on the other hand, you've got the decision making really squeezed by council budget cuts. And I remember a few years ago in Dundee, they did quite an interesting thing. They did this experiment in participatory budgeting. And so the idea was that they would actually let people in local areas vote on what council money should be spent on. But the problem was that because it's such a tight financial situation, you had things like in my area, you could vote on a project that was like, repair these broken stairs to make them safe to walk on. I was like, that's really
that
something
should be done.
That should be done. We really shouldn't have to put that one to a vote. And so it kind of became this exercise in like, more like you're choosing what to cut rather than you're choosing what to invest in. And I think that's the big problem for councils and the problem for all the council administrations is that there is this level of disengagement with what actually councils do. And there is this level of limitations in what they're able to do. And so I think the really thing you can take away from these council elections is what they tell you about the national political landscape. And it's a bit of a shame. You know, we have a problem with local democracy maybe not being as engaging in Scotland as it could be and as it should be.
I think you're right about, I don't think anybody's really happy with their local council, and it all comes through the fact that, you know, Westminster are, you know, making cuts which are passing them to the Scottish Government, who are then passing them on to local councils. And it's really difficult when you've got no money to spend to do anything other than, you know, decide, like, you know, choose where to cut. And I think, I don't know, South Lanarkshire, I think North Lanarkshire did the kind of participatory budget thing that you mentioned. And it just felt like the councils tried to come up with a way of not taking responsibility for the cuts that were happening. And it was like, you know, they were getting passed on from Westminster to Scottish Government to local council, and the local council was then trying to pass them on to the individual voter rather than take the responsibility. And something kind of has to change there. If it's just got to be an exercise in cutting for the next 5 years again, you know, if people just got to get angrier, and who are they going to turn to at the next election? Is it just going to be back and forth between the main parties, and or taking a turn the blame?
Yeah, I think any local authority administration right now is a bit of a poison chalice, just with the cuts that are coming to them. We're still in a COVID recovery phase as well, where there's loads of demands on stuff like the health and social care partnership. They're still trying to catch up with loads of appointments, and even simple things like getting your house assessed for you to come out of hospital, and just all these things that, you know, accumulate. Like you say, not everybody's fully aware of what's going on in the councils. And it's interesting you're talking about those participatory, but I can't say that word.
I struggle to get my tongue around that as well.
I've got a speech impediment as well. Well, you get to tell them what to spend their money on, right? See, that's interesting, because that relies a lot on participation. Like we had a parking consultation, because a big issue here is we have loads of wee, like, Victorian roads, and everybody parks on the pavement, so you kind of get down the road in your wheelchair, or if you've got a buggy or that, and it's dangerous for cyclists as well, because they're squeezed even further. And like, I think 50 people responded, but all you see is people moaning on other Facebook, like, ah, people are parking on my street. So I think it's interesting that level of, you know, what's the word? That level of devolving democracy. I think it's great in theory, but I wonder how effective it is in practice. And as you said, kind of, you're just effectively voting on what you cut. Do we fix these stairs? We probably should. I think that should be a given.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was only Aberdeen was the only council in all of Scotland where there was a kind of cross constitution sort of coalition between the SNP and the Lib Dem, like 32 councils. Mm. And Sidham, you know, 27 of them were no overall control. And I think the SNP were probably the biggest, than most of them, you know, only one council was able to actually, you know, because independence doesn't mean anything in terms of a local council. You know, it's, you know, like, Labour and SNP don't have any big differences when it comes to council policy, from what I can tell. I'm sure there'll be small regional sort of differences where they might at the edges, but overall, they agree with each other far more than they would agree with the Tories. And yet, because of this constitutional issue, you know, Labour are choosing to side with, like, their mortal enemies ideologically. It's ludicrous. And just another reason why we need an independence referendum. We need it to resolve the issue one way or the other. Hopefully, it'll be a yes vote. But, you know, there's just so many things that are getting derailed. Because it's the elephant in the room. Derailed by the elephant in the room. There's a couple of mixed metaphors for you.
It's a lot. How did the elephant get on the train?
Or was it on the tracks?
That's sad. You always go dark, David.
Well, if it derailed the train, it'd be on the tracks.
Not necessarily.
The derailment is actually maybe a bit more grim than just a dead elephant. Taking it to a higher level of darkness.
Maybe the train, maybe the elf is driving the train. There we go, is that better? Because if you get
maybe the train broke down and the elephant had to pull it to the station. There we go.
Let's move on to the next item on the agenda.
I should say before we move on, I have to point out the council elections aren't really over yet because there's still all those seats where nobody stood or not enough people stood. And so there's going to be a few more council elections, I think, next month.
Yeah, sort of instant by-elections.
Yeah, so in a respect, these are probably the longest council elections we've ever had.
Do you know where that is, Connor? Like, do you know the area?
There's a few, I think there's three of them. I think they're all islands. So I know that there's a couple in the Western Isles. I'm not going to try and pronounce the actual Gaelic name of the council.
Cromarin and Nealandsar.
Thank you very much. And then I think the other one's in Shetland. So they are the wee island holdouts that are going to bring our council elections to an end sometime in June.
Yeah, there was a few other ones where everybody was immediately elected, but I don't think there was any in the mainland that had less candidates than seats.
I know in Ayrshire it almost went to the card cutting that you were talking about, David.
Yeah, well, it was looking like it might go that way. If the Tories had abstained, it could have went to that South Lanarkshire. I can't believe that's how they decide the council.
Some of them down, there was a coin toss, I think, in some of the English councils. I think they all have different rules. You can look them up. There's a really detailed bit of secondary legislation that explains the entire accounting process, and it kind of sets out what they have to do in the event of a tie. Yeah, it seems wrong to bring it down to a coin toss, but I can't think of anything better to do, you know, if it's an actual dead tie.
I don't know, you could at least have them renegotiate and try and come back with something else, but as far as we're aware in South Lanarkshire, it went straight to the cutting the cards. It was a draw.
I think some other jurisdictions that use single transferable vote have had it where if there's a tie, they might rank by subsequent transfers. They might take the next transfers into account. And I think the reason that they don't do that in Britain is because it's seen as too confusing for like voters might be really confused by how a tie was resolved one way. So I think they thought, it'll be simpler if we just toss a coin or cut cards.
Trial by combat.
Yeah, I agree.
Joe Fagan and somebody for the SNP in front of the county buildings in Hamilton. Let's do it.
Stripped to the waist, nae nip it.
Yeah, it's taking a turn there. Let's just move on. So, next on the agenda, the Met has announced that it's the end of the Partygate fines in Downing Street. The Prime Minister will not receive any more fines for lockdown breaching. It's been confirmed after the Met said they'd completed their investigation into gatherings in Downing Street and Whitehall. The Prime Minister and his wife both received one fine for a birthday party. There's been accusations that fines have been disproportionately levied on junior staff, some of whom were only there because they were invited by their boss. It does mean that the Sue Gray report can be released, but it's also been confirmed that the Prime Minister had a private meeting with Sue Gray last week. Also, at the moment, Keir Starmer's still under investigation by Durham Police, and he said he will resign if he's fined. And literally just before I came on to record the podcast there was new images that came out of the Boris Johnson at some kind of party surrounded by drinks, toasting people, and apparently he was not fined for that gathering. So there might be some more legs in this scandal than we thought. Deborah?
Yeah, that picture was at the one Neil sent to the chat group, and their faces were blurred.
He was the only one who was blurred out.
And he was the only one not blurred out, and all the faces that have been blurred were fined. It's just a continuation of this stupid situation where these absolute cretins get to go party and break the law that they fucking wrote. It drives me nuts. How long have we been speaking about this? That's the other thing. How long has this been going on? I really have no words other than just I'm absolutely skinnered by it all. I just think it's such a disgrace. And how has he survived? How has he not gone yet? And obviously we know, because who's going to replace him? It's such a frustrating situation. And for the Met, don't even get me started on the Met, man. I can't say too much.
We've not really discussed the Keir Starmer aspect.
I don't care. I honestly see the way I'm feeling. I don't care. Because there's no repercussions. So what if Keir Starmer resigns? What then? We get another Labour leader. We're still under Tory fucking jurisdiction. And I don't want to say I hate them, because I try and keep that word just for real and like for real angry situations. But I fucking hate them. I really properly detest these absolutely entitled, arrogant, rich pricks. Because that it is. It's money's bought them out of this. And power and their situation, and for the staffers to be getting disproportionately fined, that's ludicrous and just testament to the government that we're living under.
I think the Prime Minister Wise was fined 50 quid, which
I know,
considering other like, students were getting fined like 10 grand and things like that.
I know, yeah. And what's 50 quid to folk earning, you know, hundreds of grand a year, getting wallpaper and expenses. I think you've wrote tonight's agenda just to rile me up, David, because that
we're not even got to NATO yet.
I think it's admirable that David managed to know in advance that these photos were going to come out a few hours ago, and he managed to keep that under his hat just for a very exciting topical edition of the podcast. So fair play,
Connor. You know I can't reveal my source.
Deborah, you've got it spot on. I can't think of any better way to express it. And actually, there's the whole thing where I've seen people on the left say, you know, Partygate is a bit of like a distraction, and who've said, it's distracting us from talking about the cost of living, and it's distracting us from talking about like P&O ferries or whatever else kind of thing you think is like the most important thing. And I think it really misses the fact that actually this matters to people, and it's deeply felt. And I think it speaks to, there's a discomfort maybe on parts of the left about politics of emotion. Because to be honest, like politics of emotion is often wielded by the right. It's often wielded in a reactionary way. If you look at Brexit, or if you look at like the campaign against trans rights and things like that, those are all driven by emotion. It's not like a rational argument. It's very much, you know, well, don't you feel a bit weirded out by this? Don't you feel uncomfortable with this? And the left maybe is more used to this politics. It's all about rationality and reason, and kind of like you can make a totally rational argument for socialism, you know? And it very much probably as a political movement kind of came out of that. But I think the problem is that people are angry, and they're right to be angry, because it's something so, you know, something so intense and fundamental about seeing Boris Johnson and his friends having boozy lunches when people, you know, died alone, or people were buried after live streamed funerals. It makes you fucking angry, and it makes people fucking angry, and that's actually good. And so I really hate this kind of, that some people want to, you know, move on from Partygate because nobody really cares and it's not that important. Actually, I think if people do care, it is really important. And, you know, I'd like to imagine that it would end Boris Johnson's career, but probably won't. You know, we don't really have I'm not getting on a tangent about it, but I don't think Britain is a very democratic country. And frankly, the Tories don't act like they feel democratic accountability, you know, hanging over their heads. If everyone in the country hated him, that wouldn't be enough to remove him. You know, as we're at the mercy of Tory MPs who, you know, we can see their own conduct, let alone the Prime Minister's conduct, and we can make conclusions about their moral fibre. I hardly think, you know, they're going to make the call to shove him, regardless of how much their opinions, you know, how much the opinion polls tank for them, because they can always know, well, we've got at least 2.5 years to turn this around. So I don't know. I would love for this to end Boris Johnson's career, because I think it speaks to everything, that sense of entitlement, that sense of privilege, that sense of being above the law, above the institutions, to make it all about him. It's the perfect embodiment of his style of politics. But unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be out of Boris Johnson's Britain that soon.
I'm just taken aback with how amateurish and badly Starmer has played this. First of all, to get caught up in his own scandal, and, you know, they're arguing that it was a work thing, he was in food late at night because he was working late. I think it undermines it when he's standing with a bottle of beer, because most people go, well, I can't drink a bottle of beer at my work. So what's the deal there? That really, literally that one beer in his hand could end him, because he has now went on record saying he'll resign if he's fine. The Tories, I'm sure, will be putting every sort of nefarious tactic at work to get Durham Police to follow through on that. And we'll be at the end of it. The only person that will be at a job because of the Partygate will be Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer.
Who will valiantly throw his cell on his sword.
Yeah.
And you know, all his centrist pals in the Labour Party will attack Boris, saying, you know, that, you know, how the principles of Keir Starmer. And 2 weeks later, people will hardly remember who Keir Starmer is. And Boris will still be there. And it's this kind of centrist liberal thing that we saw play out time and again in America under Trump, that they just do not realise that the right are playing with a new set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
This is no back in the 90s where when a Tory MP get caught in a scandal, he would have to resign because that was the convention of it. They've realised they don't need to do it. They just need to front it out and nobody can make them resign. And eventually people will get bored or people will just tire it and things will move on. But the Labour Party are still not caught up with that, just as the Democrats never got to terms with that with Trump. And that's what will happen. Starmer will get fined, have to walk, and Boris will just plod on.
I really, really hope Starmer doesn't resign, not because I like him in any way and not because I even think it would help the Tories in any way, but I just can't deal with another Labour leadership election in which so many people are going to say, you know, you have to rejoin the Labour Party, you have to join the Labour Party and vote for whoever our latest left person is so we can do Corbynism all over again.
And it'll come down to Lisa Andy and Wes Streeting.
Oh, God.
Jesus.
Wes Streeting, that was that thing the other week, but Sadiq Khan going to California and looking at the cannabis dispensaries. And he did this whole kind of thing about drug decriminalisation, which surprisingly radical for like a Labour centrist, you know. And there were some leaked WhatsApp messages that I think Vice published. I could be wrong about that. And there was one from Wes Streeting where he was just like, "Does this make us more electable?" I said, when the bad politics runs that deep, that's the first place your brain goes. You know, yeah. I don't think these people are rescuable.
No, I was just going to say as well, you can choose your scandal. For example, where the Tories could be watching porn in the chamber. They could be corruption, could be hiding some of their offshore funds, could have a PPE scandal. I mean, literally, you could choose your scandal or even how many rapists, alleged rapists, are there now? I mean, as disgusting.
How horrible is it that genuinely I can say I have lost count?
And it's a joke to them as well. Did you see the Michael Fabricant tweet where he was kind of making a joke about how he wasn't the alleged rapist who wasn't allowed to come to the House of Commons?
Oh, so funny.
So funny, you know.
It really is infuriating. And that's what I meant, by the way, that I don't care what happens to Keir Starmer. Because as you said, so what, he'll resign, and then we'll get somebody else who's the next big lefty. And they'll just be centrists anyway. It's just, we need independence so soon. We need it. It cannot come quick enough. And I just think that the party gate, I don't think it will end. I think it will just keep going on and on and on, and we'll never get any sort of justice about it.
Well, the next thing will be the Sue Gray report, which by all accounts is going to hammer them. If it doesn't, because she's rewrote it after their private meeting, that's just as bad. But so again, though, he'll just walk out and just go, "Oh, sorry about that," and continue on. Because what can they do? Like, I spoke about this before. Like, constitutionally, the whole British constitution is based on conventions that rely on people following them, because it's the done thing. And something like Boris just does not give a shit about that. We're swearing a lot in this podcast.
It's a sweary podcast.
This might be our sweariest.
I'm quite glad, because I was going to ask at the start whether we were allowed to swear, and then I forgot. And then Deborah just went off and I realised. Right.
Accidentally.
As long as you're not like beeping it out in the edit and you're going to have to like painstakingly go through.
It's usually just birds tweeting that I have to edit out. I've got birds nesting in my tree outside.
Nice.
Okay, before we move on to the next item in the agenda, have a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
Okay, and on to Deborah's favourite topic next. Nicola Sturgeon has reiterated the Scottish Government's position on NATO. She spelled out her firm belief that Scotland must join NATO if the country votes for independence in the future. First Minister used a keynote speech in Washington, D.C. on Monday to insist the war in Ukraine had strengthened her conviction that membership of the Defensive Alliance was absolutely right and essential. And this was followed up by the SNP Youth Wing, which had formally adopted the same position. I'll go to Conor first, because I know Deborah's not that keen to talk about this. Conor.
I'm really interested to hear what Deborah has to say now. But I want to preface it by talking about the context, because I think I definitely view the Russian invasion of Ukraine as like a realigning event, like a generation defining event. I think it's changed the geopolitical situation in a way that is going to be, deeply felt beyond this decade, probably beyond the next. And I think that's also like made some things clear that maybe the left wasn't too comfortable acknowledging or not entirely comfortable discussing. So, for example, that Russia is an imperialist power and that it is competing with US imperialism. It's not, subjugated to it. And, these are discussions that have been had, but that, a lot of people have just swerved because it's easier, to be honest. These discussions were happening like a decade ago around Syria. And, certainly myself and others, just thought, I don't want to get embroiled in that. It seems like people are... It's really divisive. I don't even know where to start in learning things about it. So I hold my hands up and say, to be honest, these are probably discussions and things we should have been talking about a long time ago and weren't for point of convenience. And now it's because it's so close to home, you can't avoid it. And I think like there's bits about how the left might respond to conflict that I think that don't work here. So for example, whatever criticisms you might have of the Ukrainian government or the Ukrainian state, if you support Ukraine's right to self-determination, then you have to be for a Ukrainian victory in the war. And things like maybe a pacifist impulse to be against, say, arms exports to Ukraine, for example, it just doesn't work because, Ukraine actually needs arms to win a war. All that said, for me, NATO membership, even in that context, is still a bridge too far, because I don't take the view that, Sturgeon's iterated, or that the Young Scots for Independence, I think they're called, has iterated, because I don't think it's a defensive alliance. I mean, just because there has the ability to be defensive doesn't mean that that's the character of the thing. And if you look at, the history of NATO in Afghanistan or in Libya, it has acted in a way that is also aggressive. It has acted in a way that exists to further what US foreign policy is for. And, it's some of the states in it, look at Turkey and look at the fact that Turkey has been involved in ethnic cleansing in a neighboring state, and a blind eye has been turned to that by, its ostensible allies, including Britain, including the US. And you now have that situation where, Sweden and Finland are talking about joining NATO, and Erdogan is clearly seeing this as an opportunity to, hold the rest of the NATO alliance hostage and kind of say, well, now you've got to join us in persecuting the Kurds in Sweden and Finland if you want in. And I don't necessarily trust Western leaders not to actually give in to that impulse. Whatever happens, we'll see. But for me, I want independent Scotland to have an independent foreign policy. I don't want it to be neutral in a sense that, in situations of injustice, I want Scotland to stand on the right side of history. But I don't want Scotland to be throwing itself into an alliance like NATO, where ultimately we're going to be subject to what are the big powers of the world, think is the right thing. So much of my support for independence is actually opposition to these big imperialist powers and this idea that, the great nations are the ones that determine our history of, humanity. And it should be up to them. And, we should see the world through the conflicts between these great blocks. I hate that. Like, so much of my support for independence is about, you know, popular sovereignty. It's about democracy. It's about empowering people in their communities, and it's about peace. And so, and to be honest, you see those themes in Ukraine right now as well. You know, I think there is a, you know, there is a totally different situation. They're at war. They're literally fighting for their lives. You know, we're at peace. That's a great privilege to have. I support the self-determination of nations, but I don't want to be Scotland as part of an international war machine.
Deborah?
Yeah, so I've not been looking forward to discussing this because as a member of SNP, I was working for a MSP who's an SNP representative. It's difficult. Like, I was just on a meeting there where we were discussing this with the SNP socialists, and somebody said being anti-nuclear and also supporting being in NATO, it's like a square peg in a round hole. You know, it's not compatible. And for me, I don't want Scotland just to be non-nuclear, but maybe sometimes helping it NATO. Like, I want us to be anti-nuclear. I want us to be actively passive. Like, I don't know if that makes sense. I don't want us to be going out and fighting folk. And like you say with NATO, I think in its original, when was it made, 1949 or something? Like, it was set up as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's kind of grown arms and legs, and there's so many countries involved now. And we can't really police all the countries. Like, if we're just a newly independent Scotland and we're straight away jumping into this big umbrella organization, it just makes me feel so uncomfortable. Like, I'm a member of Scottish CND. I'm so emphatically, is that a word?
Emphatically.
I'm so anti-nuclear. Like, I think it's great humans split the atom or the rest of it, but I'm not really into nuclear power stations. I mean, it's basically just a big kettle. I think there's other ways we can make energy. And I most definitely am not into nuclear weapons of any calibre that can injure other human beings. I don't think that's... I don't want them on our planet. Don't want them in space either, just to be clear about that, unless they're all aimed at Elon Musk's vehicle. Anyway, and he's on it. Sorry. this topic is so uncomfortable, and I know that's why David brought it up, because he loves it when I get uncomfortable with him. It's a hard one because, as you say, in the context of the current global situation, what Putin's doing, I feel like I'd be more comfortable with, like, a Nordic, a very North Atlantic, you know, that sort of, what is it, Finland and Norway, Sweden, then, like, all the, like, if we all had a, let's have no nukes in this zone, maybe that's the progressive way. But I do think with the SNP statement, it really changes the arguments for an anti-nuclear independent Scotland to a non-nuclear. But then, is it even going to be non-nuclear? I don't know. I'm wriggling. I'm absolutely squirming here. I hate talking about it.
Mm-hmm. The situation with Ukraine has definitely changed things, like you said, Conor. And I think if I was in Finland or Sweden, I might feel differently. Like, you know, I have sympathy. I can see why Finland might now be thinking NATO membership might be a good idea. I don't think that's the same situation for Scotland. Geographically, where we are, if Russian troops get this far, NATO's already failed. And if you see Ireland only rushing to join NATO in response to this, mm-hmm. I think it's more to do with the SNP leadership are definitely pursuing a policy of trying to pacify sort of international powers in terms of, you know, so that they will allow independence, or at very least will stay neutral and not sort of try to influence things like they did in the last referendum. And, you know, announcing that we'll join NATO is just a way of signalling that. And I think it's just taking advantage of the situation in Ukraine just to solidify that, because people weren't happy about it, but, you know, people have got a big sympathy for what's happening to the people of Ukraine. So it's just sort of like using that to embed the NATO issue a bit more. And I think it's a bit underhanded, to be honest. Kind of surprised. I was quite shocked to see the Young Scots for Independence jumping in that bandwagon, though. The SNP's always been a broad church, but that makes me feel as if some of the more reactionary elements are getting the upper hand, as opposed to maybe more progressive people like yourself, Deborah.
I think also from the independence perspective, you know, there's a whole push around Western unity and strength. And there is this element of jingoism and militarism where it's like, you know, Boris Johnson literally tried to save his career off the back of the war in Ukraine. You know, he basically, you know, he flew out to Kiev so there'd be this like impressive images of him walking the streets and facing down danger and being the big man from, you know, this big power. And I think the problem is that, like, when the SNP, when Nicola Sturgeon goes to the US or whatever to give this big speech about how there's no way an independent Scotland, there's no way independence would threaten that unity and strength or whatever, it's almost fighting on a terrain that we can't really win. Because actually, unfortunately, we are going to break up the United Kingdom and it is going to be bad for UK power internationally. The difference is I actually think that's a good thing. I don't think the UK is a force for good in the world. I don't want it to be able to project its power everywhere. And I'm sure a lot of people in a lot of countries all around the world that have been subject to, you know, the love and caress of British imperialism probably feel similarly. And so I think I don't want to have this pitch for independence be based on how little is going to change or how little it's going to challenge, or that we're still going to be, you know, in lockstep with the UK, because I don't want to be in lockstep with the UK. I want Scotland to actually have a radically different foreign policy. I don't really want to have, you know, the possibility of British military bases in Scotland after we go independent or anything of the sort. And, you know, David, you make the point about Scotland's not really an immediate threat of Russian invasion, which is true, but it is in a really strategically important position because of where it is in the Atlantic, where it is in the Arctic Circle. I think actually there was a whole thing I was really interested in, I was reading about a few months ago. There used to be a NATO radar base in the north of Ireland, which they moved because of the troubles. They moved it to Scotland. And it's still there because they were kind of like, oh, well, if things kick off there, you know, it's really important that we still have a radar base this far north. So they moved it to Scotland. So, you know, what happens? Scotland goes independent. They're going to have to move that south of the border and hope for the best. Or
Faroe Islands.
Yeah.
Faroe Islands. You said that we're not in that much danger, but do you not remember the two nuclear subs that went up Loch Long? Not that long ago.
Was this when the trawler got dragged, or was this a different thing?
No, this was like two Russian Navy subs got into Loch Long.
Well, being in NATO, didn't stop it, though?
Exactly.
There was a thing maybe it was just a few months ago, where there were Russian warships doing an exercise about 200 kilometres off the coast of Cork. And it was in international waters, so they were legally allowed to do it, but it sparked this huge frenzy in Ireland. And there was a few kind of quite right-wing political commentators in Ireland who were saying, you know, we have to build up Irish Navy to counteract this. And I'm like, how big of a navy do you think a country the size of Ireland can build to fight Russia, you know? So you get these kind of unhinged things. And yeah, I mean, I'm all for a Ukrainian victory in the war that's happening, but also we do have to try and avoid wars happening. So it's, I feel like that's the thing. People kind of pitch, you know, this difference between as in diplomacy and military conflict are at odds with each other. Actually, unfortunately, like if you're invaded, you do have to fight back, but that doesn't mean that you're not trying to find a diplomatic solution the rest of the time.
Yeah.
There was another story a few years ago now as well, Russian ships, that like a Russian battle group or something that appeared sort of off the north coast and was, I think, a bit closer than they were supposed to be. And in order to check it out, I think the British Navy had to send a ship that was down at Dover or somewhere like that. So it took them like days to get up, and it's like, really feel protected being in the UK and the strong armed forces that, you know, if a Russian battle group turns up, a British ship is this days away, they check on it, not even to actually fight them, just to check it out. Yeah, I mean, I don't support NATO either, because I think it's an organisation for a bygone time. It was a set up for the Cold War, and when the Soviet Union collapsed, for the best part of 30 years, it was just an organisation looking for a reason to perpetuate itself, and it's became a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy now that, you know, it's got a reason to exist again, because Russia is now a belligerent nation, where we had, you know, decades of relative sort of peaceful relations that they could have built on, but instead they sort of kept this Cold War infrastructure that you could argue just made it inevitable that eventually this kind of confrontational situation would eventually come around again.
Yeah.
Well, our final topic for this evening. Mary Black says that the UK is heading for fascism. The UK is sleepwalking towards fascism, Mary Black told the House of Commons, citing Downing Street's plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. proposals to privatise Channel 4. The Paisley representative argued, "This is just little England elites drunk in the memory of a British empire that no longer exists." She added, "It happens when we see governments making decisions based on self-preservation, based on cronyism, based on anything that will keep them in power." So, are we heading for fascism, Deborah?
I don't think we're heading for it. I think we're there. Did you see the recent reports that DWP staff are going to be given the powers to arrest folk, to detain and seize evidence if you think you're guilty of signing on the brew while having a wee casual job? I just think it's a slippery slope that we've been on for a long time. Priti Patel and her Home Office shenanigans, I don't know what else to call it, but fascist. What, you're sending folk away to Rwanda to be processed? Aye, very good. Mary Black was bang on the money, and these bourgeoisian folk that are out there saying, "Ooh, we're not really fascist, you're diminishing the meaning of fascism." No, no, because if it looks a wee bit fascist, it sounds a wee bit fascist, and the policies are fascist, guess what? It's fucking fascist. I'm already scunnered because you've brought up all these topics that are making me want to swear, and we've got this guest. I'm trying to be articulate and make sense, and all I really want to do is say, vote the fucking scum out. But we just had an election. People still fucking voted for them. I'm so frustrated by the Tories, by everything they stand for, every regressive policy, whether it's getting people who are in comas to be reassessed for their disability payments, whether it's taking £20 of people on universal credits for their uplift, even though we're facing one of the biggest crises ever and the cost of living, like more than the American Dust Bowl, like our inflation is through the roof, boys. I just want socialism. I want it tomorrow.
Well said. Can't disagree with that. I don't think I would say the UK is currently fascist, because I think, you know, as bad as things are, what we know for sure is they can get a hell of a lot worse. Not to sound too much of a pessimist.
No offence to you, Connor, but I think as an able-bodied white man, I honestly do. I don't mean that horrible to you, but all of us are white here. I'm pretty sure if we were a person of colour, we would have a different perspective than that. Maybe we had folk that were in, like kin that were in the Windrush generation. We could have folk that are waiting on settled status because of fucking Brexit. Like, there's, I honestly do think that there's elements of fascism here, and you can say, "Oh, but it's a democracy." Is it? If you live in Scotland, is it really? Like, is the UK democratic for Scotland? And I have to really stress this, that we're all, I'm presuming, cisgendered as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So we don't have that same experience as some other folk. And I think Mary Black, I just agree with her. I think everything she said was bang on the money. She was really passionate in her speech. Sorry to interject on you there.
No. I welcome the interjection. And don't get me wrong, I'm not defending the UK in any way. And actually, you remind me, years ago, when Trump first got in, I was on the big demonstrations in Edinburgh. And we were marching in my little section of the march. We were all chanting, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA." And this guy from the Socialist Workers Party came over to complain that we were chanting that because Trump isn't a fascist. And so it was, you know, like politically wrong to chant "no fascist USA." And I had to like make the point, you know, okay, firstly, I don't think this is the time or place to have a weird academic discussion about the nuances of fascism, but also, we didn't even say in the chant the USA is currently fascist. No, how is no fascist USA something that you could possibly take umbrage with? You know, yeah, it really annoyed me. So I can understand your frustration. But Mary Black, I looked up the Enhanzard, the little thing she said. It was a very short speech for the amount of ire and anger that it really stirred up on the Tory benches. But she didn't say the UK is fascist, and she didn't say Boris Johnson is a fascist. She said the warning signs are there for everyone else to see whether they admit it or not. And I think the warning signs are there. I think they're there in the UK. I think they're there in the US. I think they're there in a lot of other countries as well. And I think it's because, you know, we are in a world that is going under crisis after crisis after crisis. And that is exactly the conditions in which fascism thrives, because it's exactly about a situation where the, you know, the status quo can't stay anymore. And suddenly you've got this question of which way are we going to go? And of course, the rich and the powerful in the world want it to go in a direction that actually protects all their privileges, their wealth. And fascism does that, because fascism is fundamentally something that protects the powerful. It's all about power, isn't it? It's all about, you know, people being in their rightful place. And that cuts across, you know, that's racial, that's gendered, that's class-based, it's all of those things. And we are in an environment in Britain where there have been crises over and over and over. And every single one of these crises so far has been resolved in favour of the right. So whether that is, you know, unionists triumphing in the independence referendum, whether it's the Brexiteers triumphing in the EU referendum, whether it's, you know, the way in which Boris Johnson replaced Theresa May and is like discarding all these like last hangovers of liberalism that David Cameron maybe half-heartedly tried to inject in the Tory party, you know, what a move this is from the Tories being like, we are the ones legalizing same-sex marriage, to the Tories being the ones that are like, we are the ones defending traditional conceptions of sex and gender. You can see all these elements, and yeah, I don't want to sound too much of a downer, but you can see the seeds of like how bad things might get here and across the world. And it's scary because you don't really feel like we're in a position to, there's a powerlessness that I think we feel, especially in Scotland, you know, that's accentuated by the democratic question, the national question, because, you know, if we can't even have influence in the UK, how are we going to have influence in the world? But it's also a really good reminder of why, what we're fighting for in terms of independence and what kind of independence, and why it's actually so important, is because there's like everything at stake. The stakes are really high. So I agree in that respect. Mary Black trying to get that across. Fully agree.
Yeah, I just want to say as well, I remember when we were all doing that, oh, Trump is a mini fascist, this, you know, look what's going to escalate, this is terrible, and all the protests we had, look what happened in America, his supporters ended up storming the Capitol. So I mean, if you're looking for a textbook definition of fascism, yeah, okay, the UK isn't really that, but I still think that, I think we're there. We're already on that ski jump, about to just tip off the end, and I mean, there's no stopping.
I think what it is it's not really a yes no answer. You know, it's a kind of sliding scale of fascism. And by the time, probably the time everybody agrees, oh yeah, this is fascist, it would probably be way too late. I think one of the things that Mary Black was talking about in terms of that unaccountability, what we were kind of talking about earlier. You know, this does seem like a government that does what it wants. And, you know, whether it is like going after Channel 4 because they haven't been suitably obedient the way the BBC has. And, you know, that kind of self-preservation, hanging on to power at all costs. We've seen it really recently where, you know, the House of Commons, a minister's been asked about, you know, something economic or to do with the economy. And they've started ranting on about trans rights. And it's just like, you know, throwing anything in there and, you know, willing to throw anybody under the bus or cause whatever long-term damage as long as it allows them to retain power for one mere day. And in that sense, we're absolutely there because this government has zero principles. This government would burn the country to the ground as long as it got to rule the ash. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. In that sense, we are in trouble. And the whole Trump situation gave us a good example. Like, I don't even think most people in America realise how close they came to the abyss. Mm-hmm. On January the 6th, and I've seen loads of American leftists that completely dismiss what happened that day. Well, on Twitter, like, calling it a distraction and getting angry at the Democrats, some Democrats that are still talking about it. It wasn't the lunatics with the fancy dress that wound up in the news for breaking into the building. It's the fact that the National Guard wasn't deployed, and it wasn't deployed because I think some people in power didn't know if they could trust them to actually follow the rule of law, or whether they would follow join in with the lunatics. And that's how close the biggest country, the most powerful country in the world, came to full on, you know, fascism. So I think it's a bit of a mirage for them to pretend that, you know, we're not at least a couple of steps away. And it could just come to a crisis that leaves Boris Johnson with the choice of completely ending democracy or stepping down. And in fact, if he was faced with that choice, I don't have any doubts what he would choose.
Well, he prorogued Parliament illegally, didn't he? So he does. He's broke international law with the Good Friday Agreement. Like, he doesn't give a fuck. Like, I'm sorry. I think we're already there. I think with pass go, collect $200, except oh no, we're getting a £1,000 debt in our electricity bills instead that we need to pay back.
It's good that you mentioned Ireland, because Mary Black made a point of mentioning some of the legislation that's going through the UK government now. I think that's a very fair point. And in connection to Ireland, you've got legislation where they're trying to basically retroactively put an amnesty for war crimes. They've already had legislation introduced to do a similar kind of amnesty for war crimes outside of the UK. They've got legislation about letting covert human intelligence sources, as in like spooks and MI5 agents, do whatever they like. And we've seen from the Spy Cops inquiry that they will do whatever they like. And it's horrible to see some of the stories that are coming out of that. And then on the other hand, you've got the policing bill. You've got a huge number of new authoritarian powers coming in. And I think the thing that we have to remember in all this is they're not going to introduce this legislation just for the sake of it. They're using it because they're putting it in because they think they're going to use it. They think they're going to have to use it. And especially when they talk about things like Extinction Rebellion and Insulate Britain as causing trouble that needs to be managed with new legislation. Well, to be honest, at the moment, those groups haven't actually brought Britain to a standstill. You know, they've done, I'm hugely in support of some of the direct action that's happened. But I think the reason that they're introducing this legislation is not because the current legislation isn't fit for what's happening now. It's because they think it's not fit for what might happen in the future. It's like an insurance thing. And that is what worries me, because it tells you what direction they want to resolve challenges and crises in if they happen again. And you can see this in things like, people talk about, oh, why aren't the Western countries and the UK and the US preparing for the climate emergency? Well, actually, in a certain dark respect, they are, because we've had a huge strengthening of the border infrastructure. We've had a huge strengthening of immigration control and enforcement. And that's going to be a huge part of how they want to address the climate crisis, which is shut the doors, let developing countries suffer the brunt of it, which at the moment they're expected to. And, you know, if climate refugees try and get into the country, drown them, you know, and it's horrible. But that is actually, you can't fault the fact that they probably are thinking strategically and they are thinking about these things and they are responding to these things. And so that's all the more reason to be worried, because, you know, we've got a state that has been willing to use violence and repression. It doesn't feel the need to use violence and repression now. But with more crises, more challenges, we know they've got it in them. And I don't think it is an overstatement, and I don't think it is, you know, unhinged or something to just simply point that out. We know what these people will do when their backs are up against the wall, and they will be sooner or later.
Yeah, bang on there. Just in regards to the environmental crisis that we all face as human beings, I was at a comedy show last night and the comedian said something really profound, which doesn't often happen at a comedy show. But what she said is, we are all basically wee animals that are freaking out right now because our environment is crashing. Like, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too wet, there's too much snow. Like, as a species, we are in chaos, and that's very much reflected in our politics. I think you're bang on the money. Sadly, really sadly, that's how some people in power at UK level, that's what they're thinking about. They're thinking about, how do we stop all these poor people coming to our country? And that's fascism to me.
And on that cheery note, thanks again, Deborah. Here every week, unlike certain people we can mention, who are
gallivanters.
Gallivanting across the globe. Connor, thanks for joining us. Really enjoyed talking to somebody new. No shade on Deborah and Brian.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hope you can come again in future. And thanks again to all the listeners.
I would love to come on the podcast again. I think, though, next time I will listen to a few episodes first. You can hold me to that.
I will hold you to that. So you can find all our episodes of Holiday Ungag at leftungag.org, as well as written articles that are up there. There's also a North American-based monthly podcast, World Beat with George Collins. You can also listen to the Talk Sense podcast with Kat and Erin. If you want us to talk about anything that is important to you, you can tweet us at _ungag, hashtag HollywoodUngag, or email us at ungagleft@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you use. Thanks again, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for taking part. And I'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye. And it was nice to meet you.